is interesting in this. There were two international law opinions which were tabled to the inquiry from Professor Brownlee in the United Kingdom and Professor Falk in the United States, both of which argued that the international law principle of the self-determination of peoples applied to the Dene in the Northwest Territories. The end report used the term self-determination to describe the nature of the positions being put forward by the Dene and the Inuit in northern Canada. The report of the Woodward Inquiry in Australia contained some comparative material, and Judge Woodward came to Canada. The report of the Special Committee on Indian Self-Government in Canada, published in November of last year. Again, the committee traveled to the United States. There was comparative material commissioned as in the background studies. And we see in the report of the Senate Committee in Australia, published also last fall, on the idea of a compact or makarata, that there you also get comparative material. It's a bit striking there that the international law arguments are explicitly rejected by the committee. And it is clear that the forthcoming report by Dr. Karsten Smith in Norway will have an extensive section on international law. Karsten Smith, of course, himself was an international law scholar, so but it did not, in fact, occur to the government of Norway when he was appointed a few years ago that international law might become identified as a major subject matter in the inquiry that he was appointed to head. We have had a study which was commissioned in 1971 by the Subcommission on the Prevention of Discrimination and the Protection of Minorities in the United Nations System, a study. These cases posed individual rights questions against the collective question of the determination of tribal membership. These cases had the potential of attacking the collective notion of tribal membership as a separate grouping of rights within Canada and the United States. Striking that the decisions involved all sustained the collective systems as opposed to the individual rights systems. So in that litigation, the individual rights arguments did not succeed in attacking the collective rights systems. Some criticism of the details of the collective rights systems were involved, but no challenge to the basis, to the concept of the collective rights system, was involved. I note in N the decision of the International Court of Justice in the advisory opinion on the Western Sahara. Here, a population in the Western Sahara, which by earlier international law standards or colonial standards would have been treated as a population without law or political organization, and therefore a territory technically unoccupied and open to acquisition, those arguments, which had been fundamental to many of the earlier claims by Western European colonial powers, were rejected by the International Court of Justice, therefore reopening in many ways, legitimating the reopening of the questions of acquisition of sovereignty and therefore of the political and territorial claims of indigenous populations. I would like to add on the last page a few items. The 1982 World Bank publication, Tribal Groups and Economic Development. This has been regarded by many indigenous spokespeople as a gussying up of modern economic imperialism. And so there may be questions about my adding it. I find it interesting that the World Bank found it necessary or appropriate to explicitly deal with the question of economic development in tribal areas. They were talking about essentially third world situations, particular African, South Pacific, and interior.
Strong in Quebec. And not that our interests are always against those of the unions, but obviously the government has not spent enough time in working out a lot of these details. Inuit who want to work require cards, according to certain unions. These types of things would have to be examined, and we are examining them now. We're in the process of examining the whole construction industry in northern Quebec to see how our rights in here can be assured. Doug Saunders referred to, and I don't know if I have it exactly right, but in terms of equality or laws being applied in an equal manner, I think I've seen the quote somewhere from Mr. Justice Morrow, where he said at one time, "It seems to me that to obtain equal treatment, to give equal justice, then it requires some form of special treatment." And this is the situation we're involved in now, where we're looking into affirmative action programs and the degree to which the provisions in this agreement call for affirmative action programs. Now, to show you how complicated that can get, there are many organizations within our region that which are against affirmative action programs because it may prejudice their rights. So in working out and in implementing a lot of these provisions, it was a lot more complicated than a lot of people anticipated, and including the negotiators, including government people. A lot more money was involved in implementing this agreement than government anticipated, and this was said in their statement, in their concluding statements and recommendations of that parliamentary commission which took place in Ottawa a few years ago. Now, since then, certain positive things have happened. The government recognized, at least the federal government recognized in reviewing the James Bay Agreement and its implementation, that they had been remiss, that they weren't living up to all its obligations, and they did provide certain additional funding with respect to schools and housing, at least. Quebec, the government of Quebec, has not conducted such a review, though we requested that they do so. And a review is called for to see the extent to which Quebec is living up to its obligations under the agreement. The other element, I think I'm going to leave to Mark the whole history which surrounded the James Bay Agreement, because it's significant.